start the show.
For Thursday, September 20th, 2018. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of our podcast, our long-running, over 446 episode running podcast. We're on the 467th episode. Mm-hmm. We are a little over half a year away from our 500th episode, if you're counting along with us. I'm Norm, joined by Jeremy Williams.
Hello, Norm.
Hello, Jeremy.
Hello.
And Kishore Hari.
Hello, Norm.
Hello, Kishore. We have a good color palette going on here. You got the light blue and the... Oh, you guys are a movie poster. You guys are a Hollywood movie poster. Blue and orange, for those of you watching the video. How are your guys' weekends this past weekend?
I went to a wedding, and it was delightful.
Oh, that's nice. Where was it?
It was up north in a small town called Polga, California.
A lake wedding.
Yes, a friend of ours got married, and it was just totally off-the-grid type experience. So it was wonderful.
Fantastic. I like those. I 3D printed these awesome things I brought in and I showed you guys before the show.
Oh.
These are made by Flowlistic.
Flowlistic, yes. We interviewed him.
Friend of the show.
He's famous for doing low-poly models of pop culture characters.
He does that. But then he also has a Patreon and he does other random things. He made this what he calls fabric, right? You can hear it even if you're not watching the video. And it feels like chain mail. And I just popped it on the printer and 12 hours, not that long. Was it? I guess I printed high res. About 12 hours for this thing. Popped right back off, just like this.
It is like fabric. It is like chainmail, interlinked, print in place pieces.
It's so cool
that are locked together.
Everyone who sees it wants to touch it. It's a fun print.
I want to touch it.
Yeah.
If you printed it thinner, would it have more flex?
I don't know.
Is that the minimum height because of the bridging?
I think that it's how wide those things are. You know, because the more links you have, the more flexible it would be.
So you could scale it up. You could make it thinner.
I would think
scale it up, but then you have to model the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, when it came to you, was it locked in at that size? Was it made for that bed?
It was. I don't know if it was made for the Prusa, but he does have a set of multicolored ones.
Okay.
One of which, I don't know, where'd it go? I have it around here somewhere.
I see it behind, let me grab it while you describe it.
It's a disc icon, but he has three others. One of them is the Prusa i3, so he must have the MMU, like he must have the multi-material Prusa, which is why like they are that size of the bed.
This is the modern nerd's equivalent of crocheting.
It is, yeah, just hit go.
Just show your fabric swatches.
And get your fabric. But like we were all saying before the show, that how cool would it be to link these together and make a big one.
A quilt.
Make a shirt.
So that'd be fun.
I want you to print that with like the wood filament.
Be kind of fragile.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. It's like you could print it with all sorts of weird filaments and see what comes out.
Very, very cool. Jeremy, I heard you also this past weekend went to an event of sorts.
Oh, this is sad.
No, it's not.
It is sad because I love this place. My kids grew up at Playland, not at the beach, which is an amusement-y kind of place in East Bay. And it held a lot of the old things that we had here in San Francisco at the boardwalk. Amusement park that existed until 1972, I believe.
Called Playland.
And so the people who started this other place, they were old fans of the amusement park.
It's a huge part of San Francisco history. It's basically the equivalent of San Francisco's Coney Island. Was a park along the beach, along Ocean Beach, at the base of the famous Sutro Baths and Cliff House. And all of the roller coasters and arcades and Nickelodeon toys went away and went to a couple different places, one of which was this location.
Many private buyers.
There's also the Musée Mécanique, which is still a place that you can visit that has a collection of these down by Fisherman's Wharf. But Playland, not on the beach, was like a retro amusement park.
Open to families and whoever wants to come on the weekends throughout the year. In the summertime, they were open all week long. And you would go and you'd pay an entry fee and you'd play all the games you want. all the games. You'd play all the arcade games. You'd throw, you know, things at the trolls. You'd throw coins onto the rainbow table. You'd spin the wheel, and you'd win prizes. And it was, but there was no fee to do it. It was like an entry fee. So it was a wonderful place to go and spend the day with your family.
And kids love the analog nature of some of these toys.
Exactly. Right. Who doesn't like hitting a troll with a beanbag?
Yeah.
I liked the pinball. They had a bunch of pinball machines. Anyway, they closed their doors Labor Day, and they auctioned everything off.
This was kind of cool because
on Saturday
they had the catalog was online, and you could look at like pieces of San Francisco history, photos of the old Playland, actual pieces from the old amusement park, things that they had built and painted up to celebrate the amusement park. And you went and you said it was crowded.
It was so packed. I thought maybe I'd be able to go and get a deal. Right?
Yeah.
Because it's an auction.
Right.
And who really, come on, how many people loved Playland like me? Apparently hundreds of people liked Playland.
I still see people wearing like this, the t-shirts of like the logo around town.
So did
you get anything?
No, I bid on things. I raised my number. I got seen and, you know, but I did not actually win anything because the things I wanted, I was prepared to spend $100 on, and they went for $1,000.
Wow. That's an order of magnitude.
A laughing Sal, you know, the big laughing.
That's one of the most terrifying things from my childhood.
Life-size laughing doll.
Animatronic.
It went for like $15,000.
Wow.
I mean, that's an iconic piece of San Francisco history.
It's true.
It wasn't made just for Playland. Like, there were many of them, and it was this thing that you could just buy and put in your amusement park.
Yeah.
But I guess this one came from the Playland.
It did. Yeah. But it was depressing because I know the guys who run the place. I'm glad they had a successful auction.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's that. That's the silver lining.
Maybe they could start up in a different type of arcade, celebrating a different part of history. I don't know. That's a lot of money to make from auctions, but very cool thing. That brings us to, well, our top story this week.
Top story this week.
As you heard from our fair use play of a piece of song in our opening, we're talking about the moon this week. SpaceX made a big announcement, quite a big announcement, this past Monday. You guys watched the live stream?
I didn't. I watched it after the fact.
So Elon Musk, right, came up to the stage in front of a field of reporters, and they had announced last week that this was going to be about the BFR,
mm-hmm.
which stands for...
Big Friggin' Rocket.
That's what we all assume. And not only would he be giving out details about the BFR and the mission for the planned missions for the BFR, but also potentially where funding was going to come from, and the big announcement was the first private passenger for this BFR. Now, the private space flight has been a thing for a long time, you know, from the promises made by Virgin Galactic to, you know, Richard Garriott going to the ISS.
Right. And SpaceX has taken deposits before.
Absolutely.
But have they taken anyone up?
No.
A lot of promises, a lot of rich people who wanted to go into space. And they announced that the billionaire that's going to do it is a Japanese billionaire.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, I like the guy. He seems like a very self-effacing. He got up there. He had a lot of really positive things to say about the mission and what he wants to do specifically with it. He didn't just buy his seat. He bought all the seats.
That's the interesting thing. He had a home. It's not like he was going to take part in some of the mission. The mission is his.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's going to give out some golden tickets.
This is the most Willy Wonka thing.
That's exactly it.
Ever. Right? Like... Talk about like there's a photo on as eccentric and weird and like controversial as Elon Musk is. This photo of Elon Musk with this Japanese billionaire on his shoulders.
Yeah, that was weird.
Standing in front of what looks like a rocket, and this is like the most weird Willy Wonka thing
ever. I'm trying to forget about that.
Not the weirdest Elon Musk media appearance in the last couple weeks, but...
Yeah, you know, my parents brought that up over dinner a couple nights ago. Oh, yeah, you know the guy who made your car? He's a pothead. Oh, boy.
The billionaire's name is Yusaku Maezawa, right?
What I dug about this, like, buying out the mission, is he talked about bringing artists to the moon. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think there was initial pushback, but I think that's totally wrong. I love the idea of artists going to the moon and bringing the experience back with them. That's something that, like... scientists aren't good at doing.
A little few details about this guy. Made his money running Japan's largest online a clothing retailer, and has been interested in technology. I think, like, I was chatting with Will about this yesterday. He has some new tech where, like, you put on a suit with QR markers, tracking markers, essentially, and they can use that with computer vision to fit your clothing for you. But worth billions. He apparently spent over $100 million on a painting last year. And so he's a big patron of the arts and, I guess, of science now.
And a designer himself.
And not only did he buy all the seats, the number of seats is interesting. It's 6 to 8 artists from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
What is this application process going to be like? How will these golden tickets be handed out?
I think that you might be invited. I don't think that there's an application process.
An open RFA.
Yeah. So it's his most favorite.
I think it's invite only. Yeah.
Artists, musicians, painters, directors.
I like that one.
Right? Film directors?
Yep.
Interesting, right? Bringing a camera for this mission. Now, the mission would be in this BFR. And what we would learn about the BFR is also the volume, the size, the payload capacity. And it's a massive, massive ship.
It is huge.
It's going to be the kind of thing that's necessary for us to consider going to Mars. So, like, this is this is a necessary step forward for all, like, the hating that exists for this launch program. I think the rocket is, like, the one part that is, you know, sort of untouchable. It's a reasonable thing to be doing. The interesting model, like, they listed out basically the path. This will basically fly to the moon and then use a lunar gravity assist to push it back towards Earth.
To be clear,
this is not landing on the moon.
It is not landing on the moon.
But because so much of the presentation ahead of that was talking about the landing capabilities of BFR, why they have these three fins. Excuse me.
That's landing to reuse the rocket.
Got it. Landing to reuse the rocket. And the way it would come back is, as Elon Musk said, is very unintuitive. It kind of like a very high angle of attack. Mm-hmm. It doesn't aim down.
He compared it to a skydiver,
right,
as opposed to an airplane.
And then, which is how the shuttles used to re-enter,
exactly, right?
Right.
Very high angle of attack. And then you basically point it up and shoot the rockets down. When is this mission slated for?
So no one knows because they didn't announce it. There's guesses out there.
I thought it was generally 5 years from now.
Yeah.
No, didn't they?
Yeah, but that means nothing.
Yeah.
You know, that's like scientists speak for, like, we don't know when this is actually going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the 5-year horizon window. So people are saying, like, it could be out to 2024. There's some people that have guessed because of the 50th anniversary, the last time we flew to the moon,
right,
which would be the end of 2022. So, like, it's in that picture,
that's,
but there's big technical questions.
So from
about
your perspective, that seems like, sounds to me like an arbitrary goal.
Yeah.
But two, like, is it worth pushing for those arbitrary goals? Like,
no.
The race to the moon was kind of an arbitrary goal before the end of the decade.
Well, I mean, that was part of a war, right? And so I think that it wasn't as arbitrary as, like, there was a willingness to take risks. Like, we can argue in retrospect whether it was worth taking those,
right,
risks, but there was a driving factor that everyone was subscribed to. This is a private company.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have that. Like, no one else is racing them that we know about. There's no, like, incentive outside of just fulfilling what he said in a keynote. I'd say there's two things that I really look for. There's the technical issue. Like, you don't fly humans before you test the rocket, right? And you're going to test it probably half a dozen times, if not more. So there's a lot of launches that have to happen with the BFR before we're even thinking about sending a human out there. So
there's scarcity because there's only so many launch windows, so many engineers they could throw at that problem when they're working on simultaneous missions to have crewed missions to ISS.
Not to mention the cost, potentially, of failures.
Yeah, so that's why even though there's accelerating number of launches, I still am skeptical about the time window from that. The bigger question is, like, who the hell is paying for this? Like,
it can't just be this one
billion. Yeah, because NASA's not going to pay for it. Like, let's get some things out of the way. NASA's not paying for this. There might be some money based off of some agreements to pay for the development. But really, no government is going to pay for this private trip. And then additionally, on top of that, SpaceX, I don't think, has the money to pay for it on its own.
No, they don't. Elon said that SpaceX was going to be earning money. They have been earning money from taking payloads up to the ISS so far, and they will be doing manned flights, taking taking astronauts up in the near future, which he said was crucial to the future of this project.
Yeah, I don't know if that's enough profit in there to
What's
pay for
the operating
this.
Cost? Is it like with the $3 billion fortune of this one man, could that pay for development, R&D, and the actual launch of this mission?
Probably pretty close.
Yeah, right. Well, he could all put it. He could put it all in Bitcoin and double his money in a couple of years, and then that would pay for
it's
it.
Not even funny. I was surprised. Never mind. I won't go into that.
They're building one rocket. This is an expensive thing to build. It's not like the shuttle program where they plan on building many. They're building one. This will be the test rocket, right? The test vehicle. So if there's any problems with this, that pushes their timeline back and increases the cost.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is Elon said that he's not even 100% sure this will make it to flight, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have somebody who's already invested a substantial amount of money in this project, and the rocket might not even make it up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive. I mean, that's commitment. That is a dream and trying to stick to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should temper our expectations. I mean, Elon was trying to do that. They're still doing material science on what, like, this rocket should be made out of. Still at this point. So, I mean, there's...
Well, it's not the rocket. The rocket will be...
The rocket's still going to be made and go forward, but, like, whether this rocket is suited for this type of mission. Mm. So there's still, like, formulation problems. Like, we're at that stage. That's how far out we are from this. There isn't, like, this design that's already been constructed that's ready to fly.
Well, I mean...
Let's just be clear about that.
To define our terms, the BFR sits on top of a rocket. It has engines, the seven of the engines that will share design from SpaceX's other rockets. So it's really about payload. It's really about putting something on, you know, Falcon Heavy.
Yeah.
And setting it up there.
Yes.
Isn't it much bigger than Falcon Heavy?
Yes.
I mean, this is like rivals Saturn V, right? This is a mammoth rocket, BFR. If you look at the comparisons.
Like the diameter and
just
size.
The size, yeah.
I mean, it's 1,000 cubic meters of volume. I think we're inside. It should, you could fit like a, what do you say, like a passenger plane on the inside of the cavity. Yeah.
More than a roadster.
It's pretty big.
He also talked about the importance of fun, you know, which I thought was interesting. I mean, how many times do you hear NASA say that? Never.
There's a natural aversion to fun and
I give NASA more credit than that. Like, if you follow their social accounts, they are definitely having a little bit more fun.
Rogue NASA.
No. There's real NASA that has fun, too. But, yes.
Selfie some curiosity.
Fun will be had between 1:30 and 1:45.
Yes, and then you have to fill out a report on how much fun you had and quantify it. But I agree that it is important that we need aspirational goals. If you read some of Neil Tyson's latest books on this topic, he would argue that aspiration is important, but not enough to get us as a species to a location like the moon.
What is?
Just having fun and like the vision for it is typically not enough if you look at our history.
Fun can only be a byproduct.
We need economic motivation.
Coincidentally, there was an episode of This American Life that I listened to this week that interviewed one of the astronauts on, what was it, Apollo 8?
Yeah, it was 8. He flew with Jim Lovell. Yeah.
Oh, you heard this too?
Mm-hmm.
And it was the group of astronauts that took the moonrise photo, or Earthrise, sorry, the Earthrise photo, the famous photo of Earth rising over the lunar horizon. And as they came around the moon before the mission that landed on the moon. And no one at NASA had thought to take that photo. They were surveying the moon, looking for a landing site. And then when the astronauts saw it, you hear the audio of it, and they're all just taken by it. They're amazed at the sight. They're emotionally moved.
Overview.
And they say, hand me that camera. Hand me the film. Hand me the color film, quickly. And then they get that shot.
It's the human element.
That is a great listen if you haven't heard it, because this is the first time I've ever heard an astronaut talk about not being that excited about going to space.
Yeah.
And it was a really funny story.
This is the kind of thing that I would love to have in VR also.
Well,
right. Now they have all the data.
Well, no,
we're coming to that.
I know we'll get to it, but this you will be able to do this in VR.
You're talking about the BFR thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I was talking about the old archival, you know, recreating the archival experience.
That'd be cool.
And what it would be like either at Mission Control or even on the rocket itself. All right. From our biggest story this week, let's jump into our next section. Our top story in pop culture this week. I made a case for this to be the top story this whole week at 21 million views on YouTube. I don't know if that's a record or something, but it sure sounds like a lot. A day after it came out, mm-hmm. we have the first release of the Captain Marvel teaser trailer. The release of the first Captain Marvel trailer, the teaser.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you guys think?
I liked it.
So we're going to come from a few different perspectives here. Jeremy, what you know about Captain Marvel is basically what we told you on the podcast a couple weeks ago.
What I know about most things is what you guys tell me.
But, no, yes. Pop culture related, Marvel related for sure. And Kishore, you had high expectations knowing the character, knowing the cosmic significance of Captain Marvel, and also the MCU significance of this character. So it was a teaser for sure. But
we've learned not to trust what we see will end up in the final product with Marvel movies.
Totally, especially anything related to a final battle, any confrontations. But there's a lot we can glean from this teaser.
I love that, by the way, when you get new, different footage in the trailers.
Really?
Yeah, I know people.
Oh, that's a bait and switch.
Oh, I love that.
Because the bait and switches so far haven't really affected the outcomes of movies to me. I don't mind it. I actually kind of dig it. It makes it easier to watch trailers.
Well,
the Joey Famili effect.
I'm
you know?
So in tune with having to watch the trailers that I'll remember the cadence of the way things were said. And then when I see it in the movie,
it's a different cut.
It takes
a different take.
Which I like. If it's the same, it takes me out. And I'm like, oh, there's that trailer clip.
Or the music isn't the music you thought. You had temp music. You had trailer temp music in your head.
I mean, when you rewind to Infinity War, like, in the teaser that has Thanos' words are like the first thing he says in the movie. Yeah. So it's like done with.
Yeah. Back to Henry Cavill reloading his arms in the Mission Impossible trailer has Foley audio that is not in the final movie.
Oh,
and I know people who are
that's
disappointed because of that.
Well, anyways, back to Captain Marvel. I gleaned a few things. So if you haven't seen the trailer, this is slightly spoiler, but I think we feel comfortable with it. I think we gleaned from it that it's not going to be a traditional origin story where we start with – my expectation is we're not going to start with her, like, growing up on Earth.
Through flashbacks.
Yeah, it's going to be told through some form of a flashback.
Yeah, yeah. And jumping right into the middle of it. The big thing, if you haven't been following this and if you're new to it, because many people just watch the movies, maybe don't follow the trailers. And that's what makes modern-day trailers an interesting thing. You know, 20 years ago – 21 million people would not have watched a trailer for an anticipated blockbuster. They would have either seen it before a movie and be surprised and curious about a film. Here, those people we're bought in already. 21 million people are bought into a film, curious about it, know about the character, and want to know more.
I don't know.
So the trailer doesn't have to do the same job a movie trailer had to do.
I think Kishore is probably responsible for 1 million of those clicks.
Yeah, a lot of reloads, a lot of control R's there.
I thought it was cool how they linked it with Infinity War. Even though it's not chronological.
What do you mean?
At the end of Infinity War,
yes,
Nick Fury calls
stinger.
Up, you know, the logo of mm-hmm. Captain Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie is clearly about their relationship in some way or another.
And it has a shot of that pager.
But
the space pager.
It's decades ago.
It's decades ago. It doesn't have the accessories. So it's just the visual callback. The decades ago thing, I think, is the big surprise for a lot of people. Unless you were following the movie. Because the very first, third shot of the film is of a blockbuster. Right, it opens up. First of all, props to YouTube and Marvel Studios for not doing one of those 3-second quick cut trailers.
Yes,
you're about to watch the trailer. Now let's watch the trailer.
Thank you.
It just literally opens up, not even with that the green MPAA approved sign. It opens up with the first shot of the trailer. Like you had to make sure your sound was on. That it worked.
If you watch it on Apple TV, there is the green sign.
Oh, there is.
Yeah,
maybe that's a legal thing.
There's not the super cut though.
Yeah. So she falls into a blockbuster. Which sets up immediately in the layman's head, what? Blockbusters? This is different. And then they just have these little cues from the t-shirt she's wearing to the appearance of the pager to finally a familiar voice, Samuel L. Jackson's voice, Nick Fury. And when you see him, whoa.
He is significantly de-aged.
It is. Their de-aging tech is they're going to use it not just in a flashback. It's going to be throughout the entire movie.
Yeah.
And then Coulson gets de-aged?
I think he just has a wig. A little makeup and a wig. Oh, maybe a few wrinkles taken off on his
so
face.
Are you concerned about that? Are you concerned about the uncanny valley?
From a technological standpoint, it could go either way. From the 3 seconds that we saw of him in the trailer, it looked good.
And the Robert Downey stuff was great. And what was it, Spider-Man?
But that was the Robert Downey stuff was in Civil War. Remember?
And that was, I thought that was okay.
That was okay. It was an extended scene. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't dwelled upon. If you saw Ant-Man and the Wasp, they do it for Michelle Pfeiffer and Michael Douglas.
It
looks better.
Kurt Russell was also
dwelled
better.
Upon. Here, it's almost like a CG character. It's like Sam Jackson is basically performing performance capture with his body on location. I don't know if he has tracking markers on his face.
Right.
But his hair is different. It is a markedly different visual look for him than the Sam Jackson we know.
And you don't get enough in the trailer to see if it's going to bug you or not.
Yeah, right. It could. Or if it doesn't, then this would be a sea change for actors. This could be the whole... I mean, we had glimpses of this back. Remember when the Benjamin Button came out? Mm-hmm. And Brad Pitt had... there was a body double for him as the old man. But that moment when he crossed it and it's young Brad Pitt. And it's like, oh, that's Brad Pitt from Legends of the Fall, Brad Pitt. Like, it wasn't the entire movie, but it was convincing. If they have enough confidence, they can do this for an entire movie. I think it's going to open up a lot of doors for a lot of different types of stories we can tell with actors. And tapping into the
also
public
a lot of potential mistakes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's keep making Indiana Jones movies.
I don't think Harrison Ford would be down with that. He can't move as fast. He can't physically move as fast. Other things in the trailer, a bold move. Now, calculated or oversight? When Captain Marvel punches the old lady.
Oh, no, that's perfect, because it's synced up with the voiceover that says, we never know who our enemies are, or something to that effect.
So, but it could also be read as, for a complete layperson, Captain Marvel is just sinister. She's just, like, punching old ladies.
You can't wait to find out what that's about.
That was just a bit of nerd treat out there for...
You think so? They couldn't have just had a quick shape-shifting change or something?
Nerd treat.
Yeah, that was like a little nerd kibble. Where they're like,
all
here
the
you
nerds
go.
Were so grateful.
No, because that's why we were talking about the granny punch so much.
The conspiracy part of my brain says that this was calculated. That Marvel knew that this being relatively out of context, this one shot, would spur a lot of discussion about it and then get people curious about the Skrulls. Because they don't show the Skrulls.
They do.
Oh, it's a very, very brief shot.
Brief shot at them at the beach.
Yeah.
What are the Skrulls?
They're probably the antagonist of this movie. They're an alien race that has shape-shifting capabilities.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And the running theory is that one of the characters we see in the trailer that's not a Skrull visually is actually a Skrull. I'm not going to say who, because I don't want to spoil with internet theories.
This kind of, like, if you're really interested in source material, go read Secret Invasion. Excellent sort of primer for all of this stuff, and probably where Marvel will head. It seems like that's a natural place to go.
Oh yeah. Big crossover event.
I thought the fading of her into a hero was effective, and my 8-year-old daughter watched the trailer, and she said, I want to see that.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember, this is the first female-helmed solo superhero movie.
That's right.
And, like, how important that could be. And
a Marvel movie, not superhero movie. We have Catwoman and Elektra, but I don't think those count.
Supergirl.
Supergirl, yes. Yep.
Oh, right. that movie was bad, too.
Yeah, they were all bad, yep.
That's terrible. I will say, what really got me hyped is just that very end, where she is in the modern Captain Marvel outfit, and her powers kick in.
Oh, the eyes
so
light up?
So good.
Oh, I was like, you were going to say when she was in her Kree outfit.
The helmet is
with the mohawk underwater.
That was, again, a nerd treat.
That was the biggest nerd treat of the trailer. I follow a couple Marvel concept artists who work for the MCU, Annie Park being one of them, and it's fun to follow their social media as these trailers and new photos get released, because they get to finally share the work that they've been working on behind the scenes for many years. And he said one of the things they really wanted to get in was the helmet, because they knew the fans love that look of the helmet. And the toughest thing to do in real world is a hard cowl, or even a soft cowl. No one does it really right. I mean, I think Batman's had issues with the cowl. Anytime you want to show a face, a nose, how much of the nose you show? Is it a hard material?
They even
soft
talk
material?
About it in the movies. Like, they make fun of it. Like, oh, you want to turn your head.
No, totally. And it, because the way you draw, with the jaw and the chin, it's humans don't really work that way with comic book spandex.
One last note, as a as somebody that put together sort of a Captain Marvel inspired cosplay recently, I love the gloves. The gloves are fingerless gloves instead of the traditional like full glove effect. And I think they look good. They're very Captain America-esque in how they look, but with the Captain Marvel coloring. The only thing I miss is the sash. I wish she had the sash.
My son wanted to know, what is her power, fire-based or energy? Is it just like
it's an energy
space
blast.
Energy?
Yeah. It's okay. Like a quantum.
It's like chi.
It's quantum bands related.
Oh, okay. I'll let him know it's quantum bands related. When's it come out? March?
March. March.
That's a wait, man.
There's a quick turnaround from that to Infinity War 2.
Ooh,
wow. Or Avengers 4, whatever you want to call it.
Whatever. They haven't really named it yet. All right. Moving on from Captain Marvel, of course, we're all waiting. Next year, not only will we get Avengers 4, whatever that will be called, but also the long-awaited Disney streaming service. And we have a rumor report that came out this week that Disney, which we know... Bob Iger said that they'll spend a ton of money on content and they have to make it a great value proposition. We know there's going to be like Marvel stuff, exclusive Marvel stuff, like the movies, but original shows, some of which, and this is new, will be based on characters we've seen in the movies using movie actors.
Oh my gosh.
They're crossing the line.
That's huge.
The rumor is that they will feature there'll be two shows featuring characters that have not starred in their own movies yet. So the speculation is that we may see a Loki movie starring Tom Hiddleston and also a Scarlet Witch movie starring Elizabeth Olsen.
Two beloved characters.
But that have not had their due. Now, is this sufficient? I know some people, I don't know how people are clamoring for a Scarlet Witch movie. I know many people want a Black Widow movie, myself included. I think, is this a disservice to the characters / the actors, or is this the right place for them?
Yes, disservice. No, thank you.
You're saying if they go this route, there's no chance for a movie.
Exactly. This is them acknowledging... There's the marketing research that says that we shouldn't spend $100 million making a Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver movie or a Loki movie.
They
Let's
did
just
kill
spend
Loki, so
$10 million on a TV show.
They did just kill him, so that kind of eliminated that.
Right. I mean, by definition, putting it on the streaming service, as much money as they want to put in that, it's not going to be as big budget and as wide release as if they had their own standalones.
We've gotten, four movies with Loki in it? Five?
Mm-hmm.
I don't need any more of him. Like, we know his backstory. Yeah. We've talked about his daddy issues.
So
and,
you'd
like,
rather
adopted.
They have picked other characters to do, like, a Shuri series or something?
I mean, Shuri feels like a character that I wouldn't touch with a streaming service because we have so much to do with Black Panther 2 and development of her character. Like, I feel like, but other characters in the universe. Scarlet Witch is kind of, like, on the fence for me, if this makes sense. I'm just like, these are great actors. Tom Hiddleston and, what's her name?
Elizabeth Olsen.
Elizabeth Olsen. Like, they're in high demand.
Yeah.
Why would they do this?
Money?
I don't understand what the resistance here. I mean, a lot of actors are excited for TV now. They'd rather do a TV series than
long form.
Than
so
a film.
The creative decision is to take advantage of the format, not make this as a marketing ploy, not just, you like Loki, now here's another place to get Loki. Like, now we have a format where we can tell a 10-hour story or an 8-hour story as opposed to a 2.5-hour story. What are the Marvel characters that best serve that format?
And how will this be different than what Netflix did with the license? Maybe be a little more, I don't know, family-friendly?
No way. I think they can go dark with this. They can go Game of Thrones with this. I would love
You think they'll do that?
I would love a Hawkeye, like espionage Hawkeye.
That makes more sense to me.
Show.
A Hawkeye show?
Yeah, it does.
Which would tie in or lead into a Black Widow movie.
Yeah, because he has this longer backstory.
Yeah.
We don't really see a place for Hawkeye in the future of these movies. He's always going to be a supporting character. I think that makes a lot of sense.
He doesn't have to face space-powered... cosmic powered beings with the bow and arrow.
Did he die in Infinity War? Who knows?
Scarlet Witch has no backstory. Her backstory was established in one of the movies.
Right.
So where do you go?
Yeah. Yeah. Wandering the world, looking for Magneto.
A rom-com with her and Vision before all the things go down?
Who knows?
You know, part of me is just like, I'm already in on this service.
Oh, wow.
And so,
holy smokes.
Anything new announced for is like,
gravy.
Great. That's great. More of that.
I want to be sold on the service.
Okay.
Sold on the service. The thing I'm not sold on, though, is coming out next fall, shooting right now, the Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie. Joker origin story movie.
Oh, I'm into that.
Now, I'm interested in the cast.
Is that already canon? Is that canon? Like, people know what the Joker origin story is?
No, and that's the fun of it. It's been nebulous, just like in The Dark Knight. He could have many origin stories, and anytime you hear an origin story, it could just be apocryphal.
Well, they're telling a specific one.
They are telling a specific one, and there are now leaked set photos and also one official photo of Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker, sans makeup, and he looks like, you know, he looks weird. He looks like what's weird. His name from No Country for Old Men. He just looks like a creepy hobo.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
It's stabby kind. Yep. Not the singing kind.
I would not want to be on this set. He goes 100% method 100% of the time.
So is Jared Leto. I wouldn't be on that. Want to be on that set either.
You did omit something. The Instagram post that this photo is from, Todd Phillips,
the director of Hangover and now writer-director of this film,
writes one word, and it says Arthur, which points us to a kind of origin story for the Joker.
Which one is this?
Arthur Fleck. It's kind of like a Red Hood type thing.
So my theory, and maybe it's more of a hope for this, is that this is all red herring. It's that you show the movie a downfall of this man, Joaquin Phoenix plays, and the whole time you're led to believe that he is going to become the Joker, and it's a tragedy because in the end, it's really Jared Leto's Joker, and this is all another part of the mythology of people being corrupted. Because I don't want to see the definitive Joker origin story. I think it's unnecessary.
Don't you have to have some level of sympathy with the character?
Not the Joker.
But if that's what I mean, if you're going to watch an origin story and watch about why he was, how he was corrupted and the downfall,
right,
you're going to develop a sense of empathy for this,
right? Which is why
person.
I hope that it's twisted and that you do have this empathy for Joaquin Phoenix's character, but it ends up he is not the Joker. It's just a tragic story of a tragic man.
Hmm. This feels like One Bad Day, that storyline.
Hmm. Do you want to sum up?
Which is basically, we could all become the Joker if we just had one really bad
that,
day.
I love that idea.
Oh, wow.
Love that idea. Any of us could be, it just took it, it's falling down. Michael Douglas.
I believe that about you.
we talked on Still Entitled this week, if you've listened to that, about the work that Paul Thomas Anderson, who's worked with Joaquin Phoenix, and Christopher Nolan,
the master,
for in their efforts to push TVs to turn off specific settings that ruin films.
You guys talked about this on Still Entitled.
Yeah. Motion smoothing, mostly.
Yeah, please do. Please turn that off. It's a horrible, horrible thing. Most people don't care, though. That's the problem.
I mean, because most people just use whatever default setting is on their TV.
No, what I mean is actually most people actually like, oh, that looks cool. I'll leave it on. Like, they don't consider that it wasn't supposed to look like that. They just think that looks very sharp and smooth, and I'll leave it on. That's great.
So this was sent to the Directors Guild, and all it stated was that the co-chairs of the Directors Guild, Christopher Nolan, Jonathan Mostow, who directed, I guess, Terminator 3 and Tomorrow Never Dies, I want to say, they've just started a dialogue with TV manufacturers. I think it'll have some impact. I think TV manufacturers will want the credibility of saying will want the publicity of saying we've worked with directors. You're going to get the best experience now.
Yeah.
And you're going to get a TV out of the box that will play movies without quote unquote ruining them.
There's so many certifications now that home entertainment systems can apply for that they can put on the box, right? Like the Dolby Atmos is now a part of Apple TV, and you can't have that certification on TV and have it do motion smoothing. I just don't think that's fair. So I think if you're going to have that on your box, when you boot up the TV, it has to say, is this for home use? Do you want this home cinema?
Or is this movie use, mostly movie or mostly sports?
Well, Yeah, I guess you're right. Like with the sports, you might want that smoothing.
You want the motion smoothing for
and
sports.
And if that's the same input, the TV won't know when to switch.
Exactly. Exactly. Or if you're running the same program, if you're running YouTube TV or some streaming program. So there's no way. I mean, is the thing to do, and maybe this is a far-fetched idea, is to connect the manufacturers to some type of code that's in the programming stream where the TV can know what type of content is being watched, mm-hmm. and then we'll auto-switch between the formats. Because there are game modes, and there are movie modes, and there are all sorts of different cinema modes. I think TVs are overburdened with these modes anyway. When you look at these theater modes, a lot of it's like what people think in their heads the theater should look like. Oh, it should be more contrasty. Oh, I need more saturation in some of these colors. When it's, in many times, it's making up for the disparity between the quality you have on a off-the-shelf television and the type of cinematic experience you'd have. And if you have a good TV, and if you have things like 4K or HDR, most importantly, you don't need a lot of these special modes. You know, they look pretty good. Trust the codec and trust the encoding and the mastering of those video files. And we'll hopefully hear more about this. Kishore, you guys did a screening of 2001 recently.
We did. We did one at the Alamo Drafthouse. This is the 50th anniversary, so it was a print in 70mm, which was stunning, especially the really trippy scenes where you get all those colors when he's sort of flying through the universe were especially just incredible.
And these were the 70 mils that were part of the Christopher Nolan restoration, from pristine prints from the original negatives.
Wow.
and remastered. And these new prints, the work done from these 70 mil prints in 4K and HDR, will be released on disc this October.
I'm less into this part. I mean, like, fine. Like, 2001 is to my definition, a perfect science fiction movie. And so anytime it can get a re-release, awesome. But I thought there was something really special about seeing it on film that we'll never get from seeing on a disc.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, a lot of times, what you mean is seeing it in theaters, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's something there. I think you forget, because if you haven't watched it recently, just how quiet that film actually is. And there's something about being in the theater and hearing just a little bit of like the sound of the film projector going a little bit during these long moments of quiet that I think just is kind of, I imagine that's how Kubrick intended it.
Are you sure? Are you sure that's an intention, or is that a byproduct of the theatrical releases 50 years ago?
That's just a byproduct of,
so I don't know, intention. Like if Kubrick had it his way,
would it be dead silent?
Exactly. We'll never know.
Would there be cute CG characters flying around?
No, definitely not.
Couldn't afford that.
I think we could safely say definitely not. Is that more? So you're not highly. You're not anticipating this. I am highly anticipating this. This is something I want to put on my holiday wish
list. I'll buy this.
This, I guess, Batman animated series, right, on Blu-ray.
The what?
Batman the animated series is probably the biggest.
I already
disc
pre-ordered
release.
It.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's definitely immediate one click. Bye.
I can't tell you the last disc I bought. I am 100% digital now.
You have a 4K HDR TV and you're still digital?
All the digital stuff I buy is 4K HD now.
Almost everything I buy is digital, but like the really, really special things, I still buy discs for.
I like the disc. Like, I will not watch Planet Earth on Netflix. The bitrate isn't high enough.
This Earth isn't earthy enough for me.
I need the disc. I want to swap out the disc and put that effort in.
I'm glad.
Knowing I'm going to get the maximum quality. Two more things. Recommendations. One on Netflix, speaking of which, this just came out last week. I binged it. Huge recommendation for American Vandal, season 2. I think season 1 might have been my favorite thing on TV last year. And season 2, I will say, lives up to the billing. No sophomore slump here. Highly, highly recommend
it. Adding it to my list now because I keep forgetting.
American Vandal. It's not. Don't watch it with kids.
Okay.
Watch it with. It's
should you watch season 1 first?
Yes, you have to watch season 1 first.
Done. Added.
And you'll know within the first. It's a half hour episode. You'll know within the first hour and a half whether it's for you. I'll tell you. I binged also Jack Ryan. Middling at most.
I watched the first episode for the 400 bits.
Me too.
Yeah.
400 bits. I don't know what you're talking about, but I did watch the first episode.
Can I spoil a little bit of Jack Ryan for you? A thing that's going to frustrate. The show it's fine.
Pam Beasley shows up.
No, it's a fine. It's okay. Like the big credit they have, the big quote they have on Amazon Prime is from the New York Times, a solid spy thriller. Like that's the most effusive praise they could get for this. One thing that infuriated me to no end in this is that there's a plot device in the series involving video games.
Uh-oh.
And it's one of the worst uses, implementations of video games in fiction, in narrative fiction, I've ever seen.
That means he cracks the code using high score letters.
I'll describe cipher. It. It doesn't ruin the show. One of the terrorists goes back to a childhood home, a childhood foster home, and digs through a stack of DVDs, then opens one of these cases up and pulls out a disc, which is a fictional video game called End of Honor. Puts the disc into you don't see him put like a, you know, assume it's like a PlayStation or something,
yeah,
right? On the TV, and via that game, he can secretly communicate with the terrorist cells.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it would be realistic if he like goes into group chat and there's some like racist, like real terrible people there.
And then the CIA take the disc and bring it back to Langley and then use it to pretend to be him.
But they need the disc?
The disc that was on a game system from him as a child.
Right.
Like they made a full video game. And in the terrorist network, like the game pops up and goes like, console 2 turned on. Oh, now we're going to... And they have like these avatars like standing in like an MMO and they're chatting.
IGN reviews this game. Oh, I liked it, but the terrorist kind of like communication component of the game.
That's too bad.
With built-in translation.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of video games, there was something I watched related to video games, and it wasn't my Twitter feed, which had Mario Kart trending this week. It was the Black Mirror episode called USS Callister.
This is your first Black Mirror episode you've seen.
I flirted with it once, and I just wasn't hooked. But man, Norman, you recommended I watch this last year. In fact, last week. You insisted on it.
I gave you homework.
And in every sense of the word, that was a gift. It was, because you could not have handed me something that meant more than this. I enjoyed this show so much.
This episode.
And I don't know, maybe I'm not the only one who hasn't watched Black Mirror. Every show is different. Every show is different.
It's an anthology series.
Different cast.
Yep, different cast, different story.
Like Twilight Zone.
Parables about our obsession with technology and the Black Mirror that is the phone that we stare at.
And so considering that, I was shocked by the amount of money and effort that was spent on this one set, on this series of sets, on the
quality,
the effects.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But the story.
The story is so good. And I was worried that it was, how can we talk about this and not ruin it? I was worried that I was going to be depressed and I wasn't. Let's just put it that way.
You were worried like halfway through the story that it was going to be a morbid, depressing story.
I thought by the end, it would be in a way that I wasn't comfortable with.
Because it's like many of these cautionary tales, you know, Tales from the Crypt, Twilight Zone, they end with without optimism.
Yeah.
The twist in this, which we won't spoil if you haven't seen it, like from the promotional images, like it is a dark twist to, you know, a dark take on the premise,
right,
of fandom and obsession. And at the end, it's so uplifting, isn't it?
Oh, it's so good. It is just so good. And I was so like grateful for that ending. Because I wasn't sure which direction it was going to go the whole time.
Right.
And I was actually doing something else at the time, and I had to pause it a few times because I had to run because there was this other urgent thing happening. And it was, it was just like I was on the edge of my seat every time I had to pause it because it was action-packed. But I loved it. Thank you for suggesting that.
You know, I like that episode the most just because of the nostalgia. It may not actually be the best episode of the season.
Oh, which, let's discuss.
Well, I think just in terms of my own...
I'm just leaving that as a tease to Jeremy to watch other Black Mirror
episodes.
From
my interests in video games and in science fiction and technology?
It is, you know, there are analogs to Ready Player One in that episode.
Tron, you name it. Yeah. It's all there.
It taps and pushes all the right buttons for Jeremy. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can top that, but I do highly recommend watching the rest of that show.
It was nominated for an Emmy?
It was nominated for an Emmy for best like short form story or short.
That episode.
Yeah, that episode it won.
It did win.
It did win.
Good for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well deserved. All right. And that does it for pop culture. Let's get into some tech. All right. So Apple iPhone XS, XS, XS Max, XS and XS Max. XR.
Mm-hmm.
Not XR yet.
No,
just
not
the
yet.
XS Max. The reviews are out. Apple seated journalists with these phones, the two new phones, high-end phones, last Wednesday. They've been using them, and you can find reviews on Tom's Guide, TechCrunch, Daring Fireball.
The Verge.
The Verge, of course. And it's really interesting, I think, from a meta level, to how these reviewers approach the reviews. Who are they writing for? And I think they know their audience, for sure. I think there are some people within a very enclosed Apple community where they're writing reviews for essentially people who have maybe the latest phone already and are considering the annual upgrade. Some people are writing maybe for a little more mass market, for people who are update every 2 or 3 years, maybe have an iPhone 7 or even a 6S, right? And now are considering after the second year of the 10 design. And then some people just want to go into the nitty-gritty of the technology behind it and don't care about really a product recommendation, but more of like, how is Apple using the new tech, the new hardware on these phones, and what does that tell us about Apple's phone designs and path forward in the future? All of this is to say that these reviews are struggling to find interesting things to talk about with the phone, because it really is an evolutionary year. It's not the big year that we had, the big, big upgrade year last year with the whole new design, with the OLED screen. And so these reviews really boil down to, one, what does the new size mean with the Max? And two, what does the new camera system mean? And how does it make use of that neural engine? I was really surprised that as obsessed as we were back with the iPhone 5 and the 6 and discussing, you know, aspect ratios and usability with one hand and pixel resolution versus point resolution and scaling and with the 6S and downsampling, that was basically not mentioned at all with the iPhone, the difference between the XS and the XS Max. The XS Max is basically, it's almost the same size as your 6S, 6 Plus, 7 Plus, and it's the same phone.
Well, interestingly, they don't show much more information on the screen, though.
Yeah.
With the XS Max. They enlarge everything.
Everything's just enlarged. It's not downsampled. Everything's rendered 1:1. There's no, because remember with the Plus phones, if you squinted, you get a little bit of dithering because everything was oversampled and then downsampled, oversampled and then scaled down a little bit. Here, it's the number of pixels increase is the number of pixels they're rendered, and everything is rendered 1:1.
Mm-hmm.
And the only difference is if you run landscape mode on some apps, you do get like an iPad where you have two columns. That's it. Few apps.
Yeah.
But otherwise, everything is. If you want to see everything bigger, if you're someone who finds yourself pinching and using the accessibility options, the text size options to have bigger text, then this one might be for you because it also has a little bit longer battery.
And certainly watching movies would be a more enjoyable experience.
Yep.
The stereo separation is wider because they're just naturally further apart.
No one talked about how this screen with the lack of Apple Pencil support was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, no, it is.
It is, right? Because the biggest differentiator between the
Note. It feels
the
like they don't care about the Apple Pencil. They don't talk about it anymore. They don't really push it.
I don't think they don't care about it.
No, I think
that they product segments it to the iPad.
They just added it to the new, cheaper iPad. So they're bringing it down. And eventually it'll come to the phones. It's just a matter of when. They need that bullet point.
And this Max phone was supposed to be the thing that kind of replaced the need for the iPad mini.
I know.
iPad mini's phased out. iPad mini never got pencil support. And the 6.5-inch size is kind of fine to use with a good, robust Notes app.
I would think so.
And drawing app. And I think there are people who may want, maybe not as long as the pencil that you have on the current iPad or the crayon pencil, but a smaller stylus that you can use with your iPhone. I think it's more product segmentation than UX thinking.
I keep thinking that's coming, but I also keep thinking touchscreen iMacs are coming.
And
yeah,
we'll see it. We'll believe it when we see it.
When do we get to a point of diminishing returns, even on photography?
I think years and years. If we're talking about,
you still feel like there's a lot to go.
Yeah.
I mean, like obviously, we're never going to get to like interchangeable lens on a phone, on the iPhone, or at least it doesn't seem like that we're getting to that in the next couple years.
Yeah, the most interesting thing I think John Gruber's review on Daring Fireball emphasized, like most of his review was about the photography. right? And it clarified some things from the press conference that we didn't know. For example, the new sensor is on the wide-angle lens, the wide-angle sensor, not the telephoto. And that new sensor is, by Apple's report, 32% bigger than the sensor on the previous iPhones.
Same number of pixels, but bigger sensor, so they capture more light.
Capture more light. 50% more light, 32% physical bigger sensor size. And with the physical bigger sensor size, if you want a longer lens, or what you need to have a bigger, the lens itself has the stacking of lenses themselves has to be thicker, which may explain the slight physical size change. So if you take apart an iPhone XS or whatever iPhone comes out next year, that lens, that when we think of like what may be behind the lens compartment, mm-hmm. that's like all camera. There's no battery there. Like the entire thickness of that bump on the back of your phone plus the thickness of your phone up to the screen is camera hardware.
It's all magic to me. The fact that I can get photos as good as I can from a phone still blows my mind.
And there are some differing reports of how much of an improvement this new lens is. If we read some people's reports, it is like a world-changing thing. The new smart HDR that they have that combines and really lets you see details that you wouldn't otherwise see. The new depth map that they have for the portrait mode really lets you bring out like even the tiniest bits of hair in the separation.
So, and that is a factor of the new phone, is that right?
That's only in the new phone.
Okay.
And that the changing of your aperture, the software changing from like 1.8 to 22 to flatten it out,
yeah.
that's only on the new phone as well, because that apparently takes advantage of the neural engine. TechCrunch's review pointed out that flattening of the image, allowing you to slide between how much depth, may actually be useful if the portrait mode isn't giving you exactly what you want. If you have glasses, for example, or if you have if you're two people in a photo, right, you can actually flatten it just a little bit so both people can be in focus. And this is Apple trusting that masking to be really smart.
The Verge reported that they preferred the Pixel 2.
Yes, and they're the ones, their side-by-side comparisons really convinced me that's really a philosophical difference between how Google's approaching their cameras on the Pixel 2 XL and the incoming Pixel 3, and what Apple and Samsung are doing with the post-processing. You definitely see more detail in the hair and the skin, just the pore detail in a Pixel phone.
When you zoom in, you can really see that.
And it's not that the detail, I don't think, is there on the sensor of the iPhone, because the sensor is big enough. It's that Apple defaults to a natural post-processing to smooth out skin tones, to do increase a little bit of the saturation, because they think this is what's more visually appealing. Mm-hmm. Like, cameras do this all the time. Lightroom can do this. You can see a very grainy, a very pure, raw image, and tweak from that. Or you can apply some, what it thinks is just some basic, you know, post-processing. And Apple does it smartly because it recognizes that's a face. That is, you know, that's supposed to be in the near field. And it looks great on the phone, which is fine, but once you bring it off the phone, if you're going to print it out or put it on a high-resolution monitor and really want to see the side-by-side and see those tiny details...
Or if you want to crop in and not use the
photo.
Or if you
want to crop in, you may see a little bit of muddling of the pixels on the iPhone and on the Samsung phone. So it really is a philosophical thing.
I disagree. I think that is a mistake, because you wouldn't have Canon or Sony giving you the softer version of the photo. They want to give you the most accurate information that they possibly can deliver, and rely on you to do whatever you want.
And rely on you is what Apple doesn't want you to do. Yeah. Because they want people to be able to send something immediately, for you to share something or enjoy something and know that it's good. I mean, to that argument, Apple isn't giving you, like my Canon camera would give to me, five different images for HDR and let me kind of pick which one to be the highlights, and they just combine it automatically, mm-hmm. right? They automate that process. And so it is that trade-off. I mean, Apple also lets you shoot raw pictures, and I don't think anyone did.
Now you can edit
raw,
them. With iOS 12, you can edit
them. So no one did a raw picture comparison between what a raw picture looks like on the Pixel versus what a raw picture looks like on the iPhone. And I bet if you compared those, they would be closer than what you get with the photos at post-processing. Again, all this boils down to the fact that what's new this year is really in the camera. There are a few AR things out right now. iOS 12, of course, came out this past week for everyone. And if you have a 10, if you even have a 7, 12 does a lot for you. X12 actually improves performance on last-gen phones.
Across the board.
Across the board.
People are reporting increased performance, even down to the 5. Or 5S, I think.
Which they don't sell anymore.
Yeah, they don't sell the 6S anymore.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. No, this is great. This is great. It's been a long time since iOS needed this. You know, it seems like, especially the last one, iOS 11 came out. They're just riddled with bugs for months, and it would just slow everything down. And now we finally can install an OS that speeds everything up.
You know, the big thing, there's an analysis done in terms of Apple's strategy. The thing that we didn't talk about last week with the announcement is by removing the 6S, by moving away from the model of last year's flagship becomes this year's entry level.
Yep.
And now they have, last year's flagship is gone. The 10 is gone from the lineup. They'll have the 10R coming out next month. They've done is they've raised the minimum price of an iPhone. There is no $350. There is no budget iPhone anymore. Everything starts at a pretty high price.
You think those are related?
Absolutely. I think that their average selling price, the ASP of the iPhone, of their iPhone market, is going up over time, and this is how they're making more money, because they've kind of capped out the number of people over 10 years who are going to be, they know the pace of people who are buying new phones.
I figured they couldn't make it. They couldn't make the 10 for less. And keep their margins. So they needed to introduce the LCD version.
Right, OLED's a very expensive thing, yeah. Licensing that they have. And they have more OLED manufacturing right now. You know, speaking of OLED, and the 10R is a big question mark, right? The 10R, I think people are, if you don't want to spend $1,000 on an iPhone and you really want an iPhone, the 10R, based on the performance reports of the A12 chip, is going to be amazing. As long as that single camera, and it's a single camera, good camera.
Yeah.
It's a bigger sensor, better low light, slightly wider angle. I think it's a 26 millimeter equivalent as opposed to a 28 millimeter equivalent lens. Aluminum sides, it's still glass back, I believe. But the LCD won't have burn-in. And I talked to a couple people this week.
Well, the OLED,
over the past year.
We haven't had any burn-in over the past year.
I know people who have had burn-in.
Do you?
Yeah. Really?
Oh, yeah.
With the 10?
With the 10.
No kidding.
Yeah. Especially people who... plug their phones in and use apps, and you know where it is? It's that white bar on the bottom.
From the dock? What do you mean?
No, because the 10, there is no home button.
Oh, it's that little thing always there?
It's the bar that's always there.
That's white. That's like the worst color.
Exactly.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, and if you look at Apple's reports, if you have burn-in on your phone, they say they have industry best, OLED screen with the least amount of burn-in.
Yeah.
But burn-in is a natural part of the phone. They will not replace your screen for you. It is out of warranty repair if you have burn-in on your OLED screen.
Okay.
So if they're saying that the LCD screen is just as good, you know what?
Great.
That 10R is going to sell like bonkers at $750, which is a lot of money to pay for a phone. But it's all relative. They've changed the game in terms of how much people they know people are willing to pay for their phones.
So is there anything about iOS 12 that you're stoked about?
Well, I think just like I use Animojis for 1 week last year.
Yeah, you'll do it again.
I've used Memojis this past week.
Well, it's fun. It is neat that they're combining their augmented reality engine with
it's
emojis.
Not augmented reality. This is just their face recognition engine.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, face
ID
whatever
engine.
That is,
yeah.
That can see things in right. The real world. They're now mapping the emojis on top of my head in a 3D way, which
but
is
only in messages and FaceTime.
Yeah,
it's not in photos.
No, I wish it were.
To take a photo of yourself with a dragon face, you have to take the photo in a message to someone.
It's neat though. It's really clever. And you can also now drag things. I guess the kids do this, but I thought it was just technically cool. You can drag text onto yourself and then change the text to whatever you like. And then it's actually mapped to that space like near your head.
Oh.
So you, move around, head, like that text hovers. It's almost like a 3D effect.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's really cool. I mean, it's a neat little technology demo.
Okay.
But you're right.
That is AR. Then, yeah.
You're
yeah.
right. Like that just won't. That
I'm
no
not
sticking
that
power.
A week.
What yeah. for me? What is most powerful about iOS 12 is the parental controls. It's the screen time for your kids.
Not for you. You don't want to know.
Have you
looked at your screen time settings? And this is a new feature to tell you on iOS whether you've been productive on your phone or whether you've been wasting time on your phone.
How many times you've picked up your phone?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's all there.
Those are numbers I don't want to know.
I'll tell you. From what is this? Oh God. I've been, this is only today though. How do you look at your last 7 days? Here we go. Last 7 days, the thing, Twitter, YouTube messages. Yeah. Entertainment, social networking, I've been on for the vast majority, productivity and entertainment are split equally.
What is most powerful about that is the ability to lock down your kids' phones. Like, these are the parental controls you've always thought every electronic device should have and didn't.
Like, you can say on this app, it will only run for 1 hour each day.
Exactly. You can do that, and then if they want more time, they just hit the request button. I get an alert on my watch, and then from my watch, one tap, I can give 15 more minutes, another hour, whatever I
want. Nintendo's had this on the Switch forever.
And you can have entire windows of the day that are locked out. So, and during those windows, you can have always available apps like the phone or messages, but they can't do anything. They can't do Fortnite.
Great for the iPad.
It's just great for kids in general. So this is a godsend, and I'm for me, this is the only feature that I'm excited about.
Because sure, you're going to roll your eyes at this, but there are finally more robust notification features on iOS where you can do more and stack your notifications on your lock screen. Because as anyone who used the iOS previously knows, notifications on iOS suck. They suck. It's one of the reasons it was like Google has owned this space forever, and they're a little bit more usable now where you can set different type of alerts. You can have your do not disturb, set up for certain things. What was cool is I went to watch a movie recently.
Oh, yeah?
And it saw my calendar. I had a movie time and then automatically popped up and said, oh, we turned your phone to do not disturb between the hours of this movie.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Everyone else appreciates that too.
Exactly. Not exactly. Just you, and I didn't have to go manually do it.
My Pixel, when I walked up to the movie theater recently, brought up my ticket.
Nice. Yeah.
That's cool too.
Yeah.
That is also
cool. So much convenience. We'll sacrifice that privacy just for a little bit of convenience. Just so I don't load anything. The other thing that came out of the time between last week's press conference and this week's the coming product launch is, well, the answer to speculation as to where this new AirPower dock is. The charging mat that was announced, last September with the iPhone X announcement?
1 year ago.
1 year ago. And it may be DOA.
What? Like completely?
Completely. Apple has scrubbed every mention of AirPower from its website, except for like one place. And off the record reports to some reporters, they're saying that the engineers could not come with a solution to how to get a charging coil to work across that surface area and also share data and send feedback back to the devices. Apple was maybe overconfident in its ability to make this product that it promised and wasn't willing to make it thicker to get to that promise. So they may kill it unless there's some big breakthrough in the coming months. No air power, no charging mat. The wireless power is a tough thing to solve. Tesla knew this, the guy, the inventor, not the car company. And
I'd like to think that meeting went like this. The engineers coming in, we can't do it, but we can add a dongle to it and it'll make it work. And somebody threw something against the wall.
I think they'd love that. They love selling their dongles.
So with no air power means the AirPods have not been updated because we're supposed to get an update to the AirPods with a wireless Qi-enabled charging case. So if you want one of those, there's actually a third party that's going to sell that. The company Hyperjuice Wireless Charger, Hyper's company, will have a $50 case for your case. It's a sleeve for your little floss box of your AirPods case that plugs into your lightning cable, and then that has a Qi wireless charger built in if you have a Qi charger.
If you've never made a wireless pad before, it's really easy to do so. You can just order like the Qi coil part from Adafruit and do it. The only problem is that it those things tend to be a little unreliable, especially if you're doing any soldering for it. But I build a wireless charging pad. I just don't have any devices currently that are wireless charging enabled.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, but this allows you to put it in like a phone case and have it hooked into the power, so you could do that. It's a really easy like half day kind of thing. I encourage people to try it out.
I'm curious about on the other side of that, the devices that can take this power. Like the smallest device I've seen, I mean, it's obviously on the back of some phones, back on the iPhone, but how small can you get that? Maybe the smaller it is, the less power goes through, the longer it takes to charge something, but it would make a lot of sense for like video game controllers that I'm setting on a table, right? Like I want those to be charged passively when I'm not using them. or a wireless mouse. I want it to be charged when I'm not. I don't need it to be charged when I'm actually using the mouse. But overnight, I don't want to have to plug that thing in.
It's so finicky, though, in terms of charging. You have to place stuff just right to get the maximum charging load. And I think that's what's always hard to figure this out, is how do you orient the product exactly how it needs to be?
Without being in a dock.
Magnets, right? Yeah. That's how everyone wants to do it. But magnets can affect the performance of a device, too.
Make them electromagnets. Turn them on, turn them off.
Jeremy has just been hired at Apple.
Whenever you're ready, just send the check. Tim Cook.
speaking of Tim Cook and Apple and the culture of Apple, Wired, Stephen Levy at Wired has a long feature, an oral history of not Apple the company or not any specific product, but really about the old campus, Infinite Loop at Apple, and how that campus came to be when Apple was in the dark times, when it was transitioning between multiple CEOs, and kind of retrospective of the things that took place in this physical space and how it informed the new Spaceship campus in Cupertino.
That's interesting that you read this, because I didn't, because I read the headline, Steve Levy talks to Apple execs about Steve Jobs and what all about the good old days.
It was a lot of the good old days.
Okay.
Right? It was definitely a lot of, like, you know, a lot of the inside baseball of, like, you know, where offices were and the culture of, like, walking and talking and Steve Jobs in meetings and Steve Jobs ordering weird pizza. You know, Steve Jobs didn't have cheese on his pizza, and he had onions on his pizza. Sauce
this
and
was,
onions.
This is less about Jobs and more about voices that we don't normally hear.
Hmm.
Famous voices, like former CEOs, but they get omitted from the story. And I actually like this because they talk about, like, times they were struggling in the context of the buildings. Like, we'd have meetings here, and that's when we killed the Newton.
Yeah, and when people picketed outside on Tim Cook's first day at work, people were picketing outside because they decided to kill the Newton.
They're picketing the Newton. All right.
It's kind of like insider baseball thing if you're interested in. And also the culture of secrecy. When did that come about? And obviously with post iPod, with the phone. Was it the 10th anniversary? Is that really the case?
Of what?
It was the 10th anniversary of Chrome last
really?
Week.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that why it got a huge update?
Yes.
Because everything has got curves now.
This is on iOS. You're talking about mobile.
No, Chrome. I'm talking about desktop.
Desktop got a big update.
Oh, mine hasn't updated yet. But Chrome cross-board now has more of the material design that's in Google's and Android's UX. And mobile Chrome now is, to me, much more usable. The navigation, the shortcut bars being on the bottom as opposed to the top of the screen.
Where your fingers are.
Exactly. I've wanted this since the first iPad came out. Why would I want to tap the top of the screen when I'm holding it from the bottom corners of the screen? The tab management is much more usable. The built-in search is much more usable. All, I think, huge improvements across the board.
Wow.
And, it's amazing how the Chrome has just taken over. Although Firefox is pretty good these days, too. If you haven't installed it recently.
I installed it on my Oculus Go.
Oh. We'll talk about that in the VR.
Oh,
VR minute.
Man. Segregated. Yeah. I did install a Google Maps update that supports CarPlay. Does that count?
Finally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Apple
is
just...
Is it 2018?
Apple just enabled it on Monday. So they pushed the update that supports it today, 2 days later.
And then other Apple updates. Not only is iOS 12 out, CarPlay update out, but also watchOS. New updates out, yep. And the Apple TV update that allows for Dolby Atmos streaming support, which will be built into any of the things you purchase as long as Apple iTunes still has a license for it.
So you linked to an interesting thing about Dolby Atmos, and so it was. I'm now curious how Apple's implementing this at all, because apparently it has no conception of channels. Like, you normally have a 5.1 mix, you have six discrete channels of audio, right? Instead of stereo, which is two. You have six with 5.1. Your front, you know, left and right, your center, your surrounds, and your subwoofer.
Yep, yep.
Dolby Atmos disperses. They get rid of the concept of channels, and they just have the every single sound has its own positional data,
mm-hmm.
right?
And so it's based on the speaker.
They can have up to 64 different sounds playing at the same time
right.
through And then they just place it within the actual theater space. Yeah. And then it's up to you as the theater designer to have speakers there if you want them.
Right, right, right. And so some Atmos speakers and some decoders will require that you do some sampling of your room.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you put microphones tethered to your receiver.
Oh, wow.
In your room.
That's cool.
And it'll listen, it'll play sounds and listen. And then it'll calculate where it thinks it is.
You put the mic like in the ideal seating position or something?
There will be one of the ideal seating position. There will be one to the left of it, to the right of it, you know, to the back. Not the ceiling, which is, I think is a big thing because a lot of the soundbar Atmos speakers, and Atmos has top-down audio, but not everyone has speakers on their ceiling. So a lot of it's bounce up. And if you have a higher ceiling or a different size room, bouncing up and down is very different.
So is the Apple TV, in supporting this, are they getting discrete sounds?
It must be.
And then placing them?
I think they must be.
That's an enormous amount of data.
Yeah.
I'd be curious.
I don't know what the bit rate is for that. Yeah. Or it could be that Atmos has a top-tier Atmos and just a branded, you know, 7.1 equivalent.
Exactly. That's what I wonder.
And it's just a branding thing. Not exactly sure. OnePlus, which is fallen a little bit from grace. It used to be like the awesome entry level price, but high quality Android alternative to your Pixel phones. They're the OnePlus 6 now, and OnePlus 6T. You know, they did this poll online. Do its users want them to keep the headphone jack? And I think 90% of people said yes. Well. Sorry, 90% of people said yes, paying users, no headphone jack.
It's like makes no sense.
It's like net neutrality.
So ridiculous.
Everybody wants it.
Who is this headphone lobby, like wireless headphone lobby, that's making
it's
these
decisions?
It's a
Bluetooth lobby, really.
Yeah.
They're so powerful. They're like the Illuminati.
disappointing. And, I mean, I think this just goes to marketing trends. Like, they saw what Apple's doing, and they saw what other phone manufacturers are doing, and I can't think of a design reason why they didn't put this in. It feels like...
I mean, there's that space thing that Apple claimed years ago, but like...
That was disproven because somebody added a headphone jack to the iPhone 7.
Oh, and did you see that on the iPhone, sorry to go back to the XS, the thing that bugs me the most about the XS that wasn't apparent from the announcement is that on the bottom, it's no longer symmetrical speaker grills.
Johnny Ive, what's up?
I know, because they had to put an antenna band down there. And so they're on the previous phones, the 10, which, like, this is one of those picking points for nitpickers.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at a Samsung phone, the jack on the bottom is not perfectly centered. And on the bottom of the iPhone, it's like, oh, six dots on the left, six dots on the right, and a perfectly centered lightning port. On the XS, it's six dots on the right, three dots on the left. That would bug the heck out of me.
Yeah.
No thanks,
You're
Apple.
Not alone. You're not alone.
No thanks.
You're going to drill some holes?
Yeah, drill some holes down there through the antenna radios. Yeah. OnePlus, going back to OnePlus, also apparently wants to move into the smart TV space.
This is a bit of a rumor. It was on an internal forum. The CEO posted that we're going to make a OnePlus TV. And I guess it makes sense. Like, what OnePlus seems like there is some... They must have a deal with a manufacturer in China.
To put it in the TV.
Yeah. So... I'm not a fan of these integrated TVs begin with.
I choose to disagree because...
What's an integrated TV? What do you mean?
Like integrated apps on a smart TV.
Okay, yeah.
On the LG TV I have, I use the built-in apps more than I use my Apple TV, more than I use
the Xbox.
Well, that's
because Apple TV sucks.
Shut up. It doesn't suck.
More than I use a Roku, the built-in apps, and yet it doesn't have HBO, so I have to use Apple for HBO. It has Netflix, Hulu, YouTube TV, YouTube. It has Amazon.
Your interface is also nice.
It's a nice interface.
It's usable.
And it has motion controls. I can point at things. The keyboard's usable. They update frequently. Like, there are some good built-in smart TV apps.
You're describing an ecosystem that's not common. Like, update frequently, good user interface. That's not the way it usually works. The set-top boxes are under $100 in almost every case.
Get a Roku.
Apple TV. Yeah, and so it's really not that much more of an expense, and I'd rather have that ecosystem, better UX, more common updates, larger library of things.
You know, the biggest thing, actually, I like is that it overlays on top of the content. So I don't need to switch inputs. Switching inputs is the least convenient thing of all the conveniences we have in the modern day home entertainment system. The switching of inputs.
That's rough.
Is not good.
It's an LG TV that Norm's referring to, by the way, if anyone's curious.
Yeah.
I just got the same model for my mom, and it is a nice interface.
Right? Isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
I like it.
It's very usable.
The pointer thing is so superior to Apple TV.
I'm down with the waggle. Back to down with the waggle.
However, I would say the most important convenience feature is the fact that the Netflix button is on the remote.
Yeah. Oh, that's something. I mean, the Rokus have that now, the Netflix and Amazon.
And
at first I thought it was a paid placement.
Everyone who comes to my house, that's what they hit. They want to watch Netflix. Of course they're going to hit the Netflix button.
Yeah.
Even though on my TV, that will crash the television.
Really?
Android TV integration.
Exactly.
Ooh, sorry, Sony. All right. Breaking announcement from yesterday, Sony, is jumping on the bandwagon that Nintendo started a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now, with the classic console relaunches, mm-hmm. and we're going to get this holiday a PlayStation Classic. PS Classic.
This is adorable. This is just what you imagine. It's like the PlayStation version of the NES Classic.
Small. It looks like the original gray PlayStation, 1/4 the volume or physical size, so it's smaller. Two controllers that you can plug in.
It doesn't appear to open.
No, the lid doesn't open. What would you want to put in there?
DVD? I don't know.
No, I mean 1/4 the size. Well, not even a mini disc.
Remember those tiny little discs? Like the smaller CD-ROMs?
Mini disc.
Yeah. Well, not mini disc.
These are in cartridges.
Yeah, they made small CD-ROMs. Like if a CD-ROM tray... If you look at that, it has a smaller inset little thing. That's for the smaller CD.
That was a CD for a single.
Okay.
As opposed to a full album.
Anyway.
EP.
Games, though?
20 games.
They haven't announced it yet.
They said a sampling, which included your Tekken and...
Final Fantasy.
Yes! Yeah. Final Fantasy 7, right?
The 4th Street, what was it? What was the racing game that everyone played?
Ridge Racer.
Ridge Racer is Type 4 is one of the games.
So two controllers, does not have an AC adapter, surprisingly.
What the hell is this?
It's USB power.
USB.
Yeah, probably, just like the NES Mini, I think.
$100. I'm shocked that they announced this without the game list. Not 1/4 the size, 45% the size. 45% smaller, so half the size of the original PlayStation. Yeah, they didn't have the full games list.
I mean, how could they not have Tony Hawk? I guess...
Final Fantasy VII was my game on that console, so I'm happy.
Personally, I actually never owned a PlayStation.
Me neither.
I had the NES, I had the Atari, I had a Sega Master System, but then I went to college and I kind of skipped the PlayStation.
Went to PC. Bleem. So this is the days of Bleem.
Yeah, the emulator?
Yeah.
So I don't have the nostalgia that some people might for this, but my objective opinion... I think this is the first generation of consoles that doesn't work for this kind of retro gaming system because the graphics don't hold up.
Because it moved to polygon graphics.
Exactly. This is like the first generation of 3D, low-res texture mapped polygons, which at the time was a brand new thing and was cool, and you didn't have anything else to compare it to. But
it was better than Star Fox.
When you compare these graphics to sprite-based graphics from the NES and
the artistry
Super Nintendo
of the pinnacle of sprite-based graphics,
there's something about that old aesthetic that holds up, and I can prove that to you because you can go on Steam and you can find 1,000 games that mimic that look today.
And not a lot that mimic low-poly,
no.
poor, low-resolution
because why
PS1.
Would you?
Why would you? Right.
So
we'll run it low resolution. We'll run it 480i.
It looks like it from the demos of this show. It doesn't look like they're upscaling much.
I think upscaling... It would be the counter argument.
I wonder.
If they upscale to 1080 or probably 1080 at most, imagine 4K, you're going to see Tekken like you've never seen it before.
The models would look sharp, but the textures would look horrible.
But that's still okay.
I think the textures hide behind the low resolution in a way that might be kind of necessary.
You're not remastering any of these games.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm curious. I'm sure this will find an audience. I'm sure that people who have a lot of nostalgia for the PlayStation will pick this up day one.
It won't be the same as the Nintendo.
Yeah. I just think it's brazen. What a copycat move. Soon we'll have a whole generation of just our classic console, tiny console, a drawer full of them. It's a tiny NES, tiny SNES. Would you rather go back in time? What's the next classic thing you would want?
The same argument could be made about Nintendo 64.
N64.
So I wonder, though, because that has Mario and Zelda.
Exactly. A lot of first party.
GoldenEye.
Yeah, but that's the 3D thing that may not hold up as well.
I don't think it'll hold up.
No, of course it won't.
Four player would be a big thing on that one thing. Like basically, it's these companies taking advantage of those, you know, like 20 games in a box joystick Atari, like the cheap as seen on TV type consoles. But emulation is an important thing if they can get the emulation right. Because on the PS side, remember you needed at least on the PS2 a special chip to run it. So you couldn't have the PS2 Classic on software run it perfectly. It would be pretty expensive. Going forward into the future, away from consoles may be a thing of the past anyway, if some publishers and game companies, and maybe even Microsoft had their way with it, streaming may be the way of the future. And Take-Two CEO came out to say that in the next couple years, 1 to 3 years, streaming games on what's essentially a decoder box with gamepads plugged into it or connected to it will be how people play their console games.
Is this a CEO of a streaming service?
No, just a game publisher.
I don't know, man. I've been hearing this for 10 years.
Well, ever since OnLive.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Sony had, Gekai that they bought, and then they've done some streaming before. Latency is the big issue. You know, I think compression's good enough now that for most people, even at 1080,
sure,
you're gonna at 30 FPS, it's gonna be playable. But for some games, with the broadband penetration as it is right now, the latency at anything over 100 milliseconds, it's gonna be too much. You're gonna want really, really low latency for this to work.
I mean, if someone can figure this out, or if the market, the broadband market, can catch up, this should save gamers a lot of money. Or at least spread that cost out over time.
It would make publishers a lot of money.
because they would charge subscription fees.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the model, right? It's what Xbox and Microsoft and Sony are doing with their consoles. It's what Nintendo's doing with their online service, which just launched. And they also announced, they finally had Nintendo Direct, their event for this fall. And they announced some new hardware. You guys excited for some classic NES controllers? Nintendo Switch?
Okay, now this is a good idea. Only for...
In quotes.
It's a good idea because they're giving away 20 classic games, right? For the Nintendo online subscribers. All those people get to play this suite of classics.
Right, if you're a new subscriber, sure.
And you must be a subscriber to order these new controllers. So these aren't for anybody.
And these controllers, which look like small NES controllers that have attachments on the side of them so you can plug them into the side of the Switch for storage, I guess.
Charging, maybe?
Yeah, charging and storage. They only work with those NES games that you have on the online service.
Right.
You can't use these for Zelda. And you wouldn't want to because it doesn't have an analog stick. It doesn't have shoulder buttons. It's really just an NES controller at $60.
So all the price and execution don't work for me, but it does help me in one case, which is when my kid is playing the Switch, I'd be like, you don't understand how tough it was back in the day when I played. Your hands hurt for a long time.
Sharp quarters.
So I basically, now I have the opportunity to create that experience for him.
Let's take everything we learned about ergonomics on game controllers over the past 25 years of making game consoles and throw it out the window and have this hard plastic, sharp edge boxes that are smaller even. And put them into your adult size hands.
You guys are cynical. I feel like game design, when it comes to consoles, has a lot of benefits. You know your target machine. You can design. You can spec for that. But you also know the controller, and so you can design your game to employ that controller and that controller alone. And when the best games consider that in their design.
I'm not cynical about this at all. The only thing I'm cynical about with this is it's expensive. What it is, totally. That's the only reason to be.
Are they wireless? They must be wireless.
Yeah. Okay. They're wireless. You plug something into the side of your Switch, and then the cable comes out.
Well,
the
NES Mini aren't the ones that ship with that. They're wired,
but this is for Switch.
Notoriously short.
Yeah.
All
right. We're gonna jump to some electric car talk. First, let's talk about some new electric cars, because before we're talking about the Tesla stuff, Audi had a launch event to announce and show off their e-tron SUV, first fully electric car from Audi.
I saw the billboards in San Francisco for this car.
Oh,
yeah.
It looks great.
So This is what Jaguar did the I-Type in terms of their announcement. I-Pace. And this is Audi's take on it. It looks like a stylish SUV, and it definitely is going for the market that the Tesla Model X is at $75,000, which undercuts the Model X by $5,000.
That's base model.
Base model, of course. Has a 250 mile range, I want to say, right around the mid 200s. Although it hasn't been rated yet by the government agency. Sorry, 248 mile range, 400 kilometers, with 0 to 60 of 6.1 seconds, or in a boost mode, 5.5 seconds. So not super fast, but pretty fast. And 95 kilowatt hour battery. What's a big battery to only get 250 miles?
Yeah.
The Tesla Model X gets 230 miles on a 75 kilowatt hour battery, 75% of this. It does regenerative braking. A lot of the range comes from the dual motor braking system. One of the interesting things also is that it will use, at least not in America,
not
but
in
overseas, something that Tesla wanted on the Model X, a camera-based side mirror system.
That's going to be so weird to get used to.
What?
As a driver, yeah.
I've been staring at this photo saying, what is this?
Yeah, it is literally the camera out the side door.
Which they think, I mean, Tesla wanted this because it would improve aerodynamic quality,
yeah.
I think.
It feeds into a panel on the door that gives you the video view.
I think from a user experience standpoint, my gut says this is a bad idea because, not because I don't think camera systems can work, but I think that displays need to be higher refresh rate. They need to work in all lighting conditions, daylight, low light, glare, and you know you basically need like a better than 30 FPS low res camera. The kind of cameras you have in the backup cams on the cars are not sufficient for side mirrors.
But what? Now hold on. There's a bigger problem here, which is your ability to focus on it. We have the same problem on my car. When I have the rear view mirror that can turn into a display. You've seen this before.
Yeah.
You flip a switch. Instead of going to the dim mode, it actually turns the mirror into a display.
It
uses the camera on the back of the car.
But you're not focusing to infinity.
Exactly.
You're focusing to a meter away.
If you look at a mirror, you focus on the thing that's reflected in the mirror, not on the surface of the mirror. And if you look at a screen, you're going to focus there. And that takes time. That takes time for your eyes to focus.
Also, it's just functionally lower. Like, you have to look down farther because now it's on the door. It's on the panel.
Yeah, exactly. It is lower. It's probably a little bit darker. And it also, you can't, like, lean left and right to get a vantage point of what's
what
you're not
seeing. Yeah, there's
no parallax. Exactly.
There's no parallax.
So you're just looking at the screen.
At all. Unless they have, like a box, right?
Now, if they could ever do, like, a heads-up display. Now, we don't have the tech for this. Like, on the window. Like, an overlay on the window that could, like, somehow, like, if we're going full sci-fi, like notice when you are looking that way and actually pop up the feed.
Well,
that would be amazing.
What Tesla does as a compromise is it has on their HUD a visualization of the cars it thinks are around you. Now, it's not updated yet, so it doesn't show the blind spot, which is obviously the most important spot. And you wouldn't use the rear view mirror to look at your blind spot anyway. But if you have the screen on the door, you got to check your blind spot. And is that a graceful motion? Like, typically, you check the rear view mirror, then you look at the blind spot, and your eyes are trained to adjust that way. Here, you're looking at a screen, then the blind spot.
When you say rear view, do you mean side mirror?
Side view mirror, and then blind spot. Like,
yeah. I figure that's the one thing that's the one advantage this has, is that it can be a wide angle lens that captures your entire blind spot. So you really don't even have to check anymore.
Take advantage of computer vision. If you're using a camera and you're processing the imagery onto your computer, show me a visualization. Highlight the cars.
Yeah.
Give me something.
What I don't like about this, and I think this is going to be a trend with electric vehicles, is Audi is going to be offering subscription services for certain features.
Oh, yeah. I need autopilot for this. You can rent your autopilot features.
They aren't offering autopilot, but they're offering adaptive cruise control for rent.
Right.
And there's something so unsettling about that.
Right. Oh, no, I forgot. My credit card expired. Now my car can't regenerative brake. Like,
they won't do it on a feature like that. But yeah, this is like, I don't need another subscription service, especially on anything in my car.
Loot boxes are next. 50 minutes of free assisted autopilot.
Oh my God. Right. Yeah. Solve the CAPTCHA equivalent for cars, right? Identify cars, play your passenger as you're driving. Well, your navigator will help with computer vision problem, and then you get free bonuses. Yeah. Speaking of free bonuses, Tesla has officially ended free supercharging as a referral bonus.
Oh, it's over?
It's over. No more free supercharging. I think this speaks to the number of cars they've sold and the perk. I mean, the supercharger is still available to everyone who has one of these cars to use.
Of course.
But they want to make money from it, and they can't afford to keep giving away electricity anymore.
Well,
it was about time.
They also sold enough Model X's and Model S's to hopefully, you know, drop that incentive and keep the business going.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was never, you could never get free supercharging with the E3, right?
No. Only if you bought the performance model.
And it's still cheaper to use a supercharger than the equivalent amount of gas.
Yeah, the equivalent gas, but it is more expensive than plugging your own home.
Yeah, of course, because it's not your home. Yeah, why would it be as cheap?
Yeah.
Well, if you want to go into that, it's because, Elon said that we're going to make these self-sustaining. These are going to run off the power of the sun, and they will have batteries, and they will feed back to the grid the power that they don't need. And so they should be kind of...
They should be cheaper.
They should be at cost.
Right. Because this is a way for them to make use of the batteries they're already making.
But they're also the higher voltage, right? So I feel like...
So you're paying a fee for the speed.
The speed.
Which is that's a problem because the standard should be the high voltage in public.
That's fine. Now we're talking about infrastructure in our homes. That's
yes. Yeah. This is an interesting story with the Model 3. You see, at the Mall of America,
this is great.
Someone stole a Model 3. And when I read this headline, I'm like, how is this possible? How could you steal it? And I like thought of the ways, well, if you stole someone's phone, mm-hmm. you could steal their Model 3.
Okay.
Just like their car, the Tesla, because it works. It's just stealing their key, their car. But what happened here is some social engineering. There's a rental service that lets you rent Teslas. Mm-hmm. And when you rent them, you can download the Tesla app, and your email address, your account gets added to the car. And someone used this as a way to social engineer into authenticating their phone account or their phone app account with the car to drive away with the Model 3 and then disable the GPS.
Yes. So they had rented the cars from this dealership numerous times before, so that they were already in the Tesla system, but the dealer said, or the rental company said, that they removed him after he returned the car.
Right.
For some reason, he was able to contact Tesla and get his phone added back onto that car.
Now, I'm suspicious about this because even if your phone account is authenticated with a car and associated with a car, it doesn't mean that it can work as a key. For a phone to work as a key. Mm-hmm. Like if you have a phone account that's like, if I authenticate your phone account to my car, you can get my telemetry data. You can see where it is. You can see its charge state. You can activate the AC.
Oh, cool.
But to work as a key, you actually need to have it in the car and have the physical key to say, now I'm doing a pairing mode and granting it access.
Okay. I bet you there was some social engineering where he was on the phone with them and he was like, it's still not turning on.
Right.
It's something like that.
So whatever happened, the report is that it was done remotely, and then they were able to walk up to the car and drive away.
And then apparently, you said he could turn off the GPS tracking.
Disabled, which I don't know where that is.
Yeah.
So disabled GPS, and the way he was caught.
Oh, man.
Plugging into a supercharger.
I used to listen to a show on my local radio station called Crooks Are Stupid.
Yeah. I'm so smart. I've outsmarted Tesla by turning off the GPS on this car. Let me go top it off the supercharger.
When he plugged it in at the supercharger, I know it's dumb. What happened? Did they lock the car?
I don't know if they locked the car, but they immediately activated the system. This car,
this
account is registered, and now we know where it is.
They notified local authorities.
Oh, so the cops came.
Yeah, the cops got
okay.
That was in Waco, Texas.
I thought they were, oh my God.
A thousand miles away from
the Mall of America.
Holy cow. Please, somebody do a podcast interview with this guy.
It's
he had, and he had previously bragged to the rental company, the manager there, about how much he knew about Tesla's security systems.
Apparently, not about the supercharger.
Not about that
security.
Oh, well.
Wah, wah. Oh no, the cops are coming! But the car is only 80% topped off. I need 16 more minutes. Yeah. All right. Last final bits of technology news. We have some updates to the Glowforge.
I'm very happy about this. Finally, finally. And everyone else who has a Glowforge, you'll finally be able to do this. If you're not using their proof-grade materials, you've known the pain of dropping in your generic cardboard or your generic plastic or wood and having to type in your own figures, and it wouldn't save those. Well, now it will. So now you can save your own custom settings for your own non-proof-grade materials, which should have been there since day one. Thank you for finally implementing that.
Yeah, long, long-awaited feature to create your own database.
Yep.
I mean, and even like just some small variances. Like this is the equivalent of the notebook that you should be keeping next to your laser cutter with all the settings preferences.
Exactly.
The thing I still want is a feature in their UI to let me scale objects and resize objects to very specific values. Right now I'm still kind of dragging it and matching up to the ruler, but hopefully that'll come one day.
And for all those like me following the Zen Studios Williams pinball announcement, they will be releasing. They have a date now. You can play Fishtails and Medieval Madness and Junkyard and another one. One other one on October 9th with, I think, $10 for the whole pack. That'll be on Steam. And Fishtails will be free. And they announced that all four games will have a modern skin that you can turn on, and it will basically make the dragon an animated creature.
Oh, so it's the same toys, but like they've redesigned the toys, added more.
They've
effects.
Done the Zen pinball thing that they do to Zen pinball.
That's cool.
Fishtails. Woo!
That's actually the producer's favorite game too. You ready to move
on? Yeah, before we move on to our next segment, I want to thank the sponsor that makes this episode possible, and that's Codecademy. Everyone knows that computers are changing the way we all work. By 2020, there'll be 1 million more jobs that require coding than there will be computer science graduates. Jobs that require coding skills also pay $22,000 more on average than jobs that don't. So stop wondering when you should learn to code and where you should learn to code and start today with Codecademy. 45 million people already have turned to Codecademy to learn technical skills and level up their careers. And that's because their interactive tutorials have set up the standard for learning to code online. Codecademy's tutorials feature easy to follow instructions, a tested curriculum, and immediate feedback. And plus Codecademy Pro, their premium service that starts at just $20 a month, has features designed to make coding easier than ever, including quizzes to help you practice what you're learning, customized learning paths, and a mobile app so you can practice on the go. This is only a test. Listeners can get 50% off the first month of Codecademy Pro by going to codecademy.com/test and using the promo code TEST at checkout. Again, that's codecademy.com/test with the promo code TEST. Codecademy Pro, the easiest way to learn to code. And thank them for sponsoring this week's episode.
Now it's time for a moment of science.
Have you heard the advice about taking a baby aspirin every day to reduce the risk of a heart attack?
Yes.
The 100 milligram dosage of aspirin.
Those are delicious.
Really?
The chewables.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Well, there is a study that came out this week that actually reviewed that advice and seeing like how likely is it that this actually prevents heart attack. So let's get one thing straight. If you've had a heart attack, if you've been diagnosed with heart disease, you should absolutely take the baby aspirin. That's still like clinical advice, and this doesn't change that. But really, what it's usually framed as is preventative. And what they did is they had 2,000 people enroll in this study. Half of them got a placebo. Half of them took the baby aspirin for 5 years on a daily basis and measured what the incidence of heart attacks were amongst this population and if it did actually lower. And they found the incidence was the same for the placebo group and the aspirin group. Now, remember, these people didn't have heart disease diagnosed. They weren't at risk for heart attacks. Aspirin has a big side effect cumulatively, which is it leads to internal bleeding. And they did see an increased incidence of internal bleeding amongst the group that was taking the baby aspirin on a regular basis. So the study points to, I mean, there's definitely more work to be done. This is a pretty large sample, a pretty rigorous study. Points to we should only be taking baby aspirin if your doctor recommends it based off of either you have heart disease or have had a heart attack. I thought this was a really interesting study that upended a lot of data. The weird place is aspirin's also been linked to lower incidence of colorectal cancer. And that cancer is particularly deadly for people in the same age group. I mean, we're usually talking about people like 50 and up. And so there's still some work that needs to be done about, like, how do we sort of take that preventative measure versus the risk of internal bleeding combined with the lower incidence of cancer. But I thought this was a really interesting study because I love things that kind of like upend sort of just like wisdom that's been sort of passed out there. I got a stranger story. You guys have been reading your Sky and Telescope magazine, right? Keeping up
sure,
to date?
Yes.
Well, if you flip back to your old magazine from 1991, you'll see a submission from a fellow named Gene Roddenberry and three astronomers.
He did Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. And there's long been a search of, like, where could Vulcan be amongst the fan base? Like, what star could we ascribe to having Vulcan associated? In 1991, he submitted, along with three astronomers, their prediction of where Vulcan could be. And it was around a star called, let me get this right, 40 Eridani A. It's an orangish star that's about 16 light years away from Earth. So astronomers recently using the, what's the telescope array? I'm going to get it wrong. The DARMA telescope array looked at that star and found an Earth-sized planet. It's actually a little bit bigger than Earth, but they did find a planet around that star. And so there's now a petition underway to name it Vulcan. But that's not consistent with naming protocols for planets. But
what? I thought you got to name a planet if you found it.
Well, there's like a common name, and then like usually it's just classified as like by the telescope that it's discovered by, and then some sort of numerical designation.
Got it. The common name is what you get to name.
Yeah. So this planet actually orbits its star every 42 days, and it's not in the habitable zone, so we wouldn't think humanoid life could exist on it. But it's the closest of what's called super Earth, like bigger than Earth, planet that we've ever found. And it's only 16 light years away. So, Zefram Cochrane, wherever you are, get ready.
He's not born yet.
Pretty soon, right?
No.
Like in the next 50 years?
Yeah, we need to have World War III first.
Oh, well, somebody get on that. Yeah. last story.
Eugenics Wars.
Last story, Norm put in there, and it's a great sort of history tale. Walter Mischel, a famous psychologist, passed away this week. And he's probably, most known for one of the most famous experiments of all time, the marshmallow test.
The marshmallow test.
What's this?
You both have children. I'm curious if you've run your children.
You can't fit more than eight in your mouth or something?
I can pass that test easily.
Yeah. This is the test where a child, and in the original study, it was 200 children that were recruited from the Stanford Nursery School, the pre-K school. They would be sat in a room, and a plate was put on in front of them, and a marshmallow was sat there.
Yeah.
And they said, if you wait 15 minutes, you will get a second marshmallow.
You have a choice. You can eat the marshmallow. Or I will leave the room, and I will come back in 15 minutes, and if the marshmallow is still there,
yeah,
I will give you another marshmallow, two marshmallows. This is a test of delayed gratification.
Right.
It's one of the most famous studies in all of psychology because it's been, quoted in sort of popular culture. And one of the outcome of the study that is most commonly referred to is that the people that delayed the gratification, that waited, proved to be much more successful.
There's a correlation between success later in life and the ability to wait for the second marshmallow. Now, this proved with follow-up tests because it was more of a correlation than a causation, because it turns out that those kids were also from maybe more affluent backgrounds.
You mean the 200 kids in the Stanford daycare came from affluent backgrounds?
So it maybe there was more a strong correlation between the ability that your background and your ability to wait for the second marshmallow because you're getting marshmallows at home all the freaking time.
Sounds like a chapter from Outliers.
Yeah, that study that replicated the work only came out earlier this year in Psychological Science. And they still said there is some correlation between delayed gratification, but it's not as pronounced as the initial study claimed. And actually, Walter Mischel actually has said very often that this study has been so commonly misinterpreted in terms of how strong a correlation.
I want to see what the test is for adults, because I'm not going to eat that second marshmallow.
Yeah, I don't even want that second marshmallow.
What would be the adult equivalent? Yeah, exactly. I don't want to, I don't want two marshmallows. Excuse me. I want the salad.
I know what I would do to. Well, I know what I would do to Norm. I would put his phone on the table and say, if you don't look at your phone for the next 15 minutes, you get a new iPhone.
No, no, the thing is, if you don't buy a new iPhone this year, next year you get the new iPhone next year for half the price.
We did. We have a new rule with my daughter who has a hard time keeping it together in the mornings, my friends, a hard, hard time. And the rule is, if you, the a number of minutes that you are ready to go to school before 8 o'clock, you get that number of minutes on your iPad after your after school.
Ooh.
She was ready at 4 a.m. this morning.
Up at the crack of dawn. She's got her clothes on. She's happy. She's at the door a half hour early this morning.
To get just a half hour.
Yeah. Man. Yeah.
Wow.
It's funny.
That is, I don't know if that's delayed gratification or not, but that is some type of parenting.
It is some type. So just to be clear, that's every kid gets his own marshmallow, right? It's not like at one. Okay. All right. Yeah. I'm going to try that.
Yeah, I would like to hear the results.
I'll report back.
Well, I mean, you don't have to use marshmallows either. Choose something your kids will.
Oh, it's something they want.
Yeah.
Not like a marshmallow for
Maybe
you.
Maybe marshmallows was like, you know, 40 years ago. It's a little passe now. choose the Pokeball or something. Blind box, loot box, a mystery box.
Ooh.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
We are now officially 1 week away from Oculus Kinect 5. Oh, what will we see there? What will we see there?
What will we see there?
Well, one of the things we know we'll see, because they announced it this week, is The Void will be there.
Yeah, that's cool. That thing that we've tried in the
Secrets
Anaheim.
Secrets of the Galactic Empire, the Star Wars experience. So it tells me that it's portable, which is cool. They can set up.
Yeah.
It's just software, right?
Maybe we'll get to see inside, behind the curtain.
Oh, I don't know about that. That would be cool, though.
Because I don't need to play it again.
I want to play it again. Don't
who doesn't?
Play it?
I do. But there's going to be a line, and there's going to be, you know, the nonstop. It's just going to be everyone there is going to want to play that, more so than in Anaheim. It's
That's right. Everyone's there for VR, not just for Star Wars. But, yeah, maybe we'll get in touch with them and be able to talk about their development process. And
that'd be awesome.
Talk about, you know, get the little tour of how it works.
After them, we won't be saying Santa Cruz anymore. We'll be saying the Oculus insert word.
You think so? You don't think they'll just call it Santa Cruz?
No, I don't think so.
No way they're calling it Santa Cruz.
They've had code names for every headset.
What's our bet on the name? We don't know.
I have no idea. I don't know.
Oculus farther.
Oculus gone. Going. The Oculus go, going, gone.
Okay. All right. Whatever. I'll be curious to see what it is.
Jumping back to the top story this week, one of the things that you alluded to, Elon Musk sent a tweet, because that's where he makes all his announcements, that the BFR launch, whenever it happens, will have included a high-quality VR live stream.
This is great. Like, he doesn't even know if the rocket's getting off the ground. They're pretty sure they've got the rocket design nailed down, but they're not 100%. But he knows for certain they're definitely going to do a VR live
stream. And I love
that
he caveated it with, like, oh, we know, within standard delay is going to be speed of light. Speed of light delay, of course, the latency, but it'll be live, quote unquote live. I guess all you need to make this claim is, one, know the bandwidth limitations from that rocket,
right?
And then two, have to designate a spot to put a camera.
Yep.
Did Will immediately reply to the tweet and be like, that's 360 video, that's not VR?
What do you know, man? Maybe they're doing some crazy light field Kinect thing in
It's 5 years from now. Who knows?
Exactly.
Who knows?
Exactly.
Who knows? But all right, we'll look forward to that.
Dude, that's going to be cool, though. Seriously, if they can pull that off,
yeah.
Tune into that, because they're up there for a week or so, right? That would be exciting. That'd be great.
You're basically in the robot's chair.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Starman or whatever.
Magic Leap. Hey, there's a conference coming up for Magic Leap in LA, and some developers are already showing off some of their new software titles for this, including Rovio for what makes perfect sense. Angry Birds game made for Magic Leap.
It does make sense.
I really want to try this. I think it's something with one controller. So how do you have a slingshot?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. The slingshot is mounted in the AR, and you pull it back with the controller.
So you're only pulling back. It's not a two-handed slingshot.
Right.
It has a fix on the ground somewhere.
In the game, it wasn't two fingers. Yeah, it was just one.
Yeah,
and it's cool. So you can, it looks like, what I liked about the videos is they don't cheat too much. They do show a fully opaque image. That's cheating. But they show a lot of the actual jitter that happens. You know, so it's hard to actually capture the accurate thing.
They need to figure this out. And it's not going to be a killer app by any means for Magic Leap, but these are early devs figuring out what it means to make games in AR.
Yep.
And Rovio probably is anticipating putting this on whatever Apple comes out with.
That's right.
Right?
That's an interesting point.
Their headset, so they got to figure out the UI. Right now, the UI looks very much like the phone UI for Angry Birds, the classic now, you know, three buttons, your stars, how many stars you get, replay, complete the mission. But how do you place objects in a space when everyone's space is different?
Yeah, and it's still going to be relative to the slingshot. Like wherever that is placed, I assume that has to be in a certain angle from the set.
Or can you scale?
Because they've placed
scale down
TNT in strategic areas, like so you can explode them with the right angle and things.
What if
like
my
that.
Room is smaller and there's no place for that TNT in this map?
I know, and everyone's table is going to be different than other people's tables.
Exactly, and there's no occlusion like behind a couch or something.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting problems.
Things that they'll need to solve. Reasons why we're excited. There's also speaking of hardware updates for Steam VR. The Knuckles controller now has a Revision 3 minor update. To the Revision 2 Knuckles controller.
What's new?
Just some minor feedback. They have like longer battery life. The USB ports are a little recessed. The lock-in clip is a little different. The trigger is stronger. System button is recessed. That kind of stuff. So they're making a lot more of these.
This is strictly Valve.
Strictly Valve. They're making a lot more. They're sending it out. What does this mean for either a next-gen Valve VR experience or them making hardware and selling first-party as opposed to working with a company like HTC?
They've done it before with the Steam Box and the Steam controller.
You know, the only way this would be killer is if there was a killer game for it. What could they be
making? If only there were a game company that could make killer games for it.
Ah, that's you mean 10 years ago, Valve?
Well, no, they're working on, three of them?
Card games?
Have they announced that card game is one of the VR games? I didn't think so.
Oh, they're only there for three VR games. That's right. That's right. Yeah. All right. There'll be the room for what was the thing called? The sampler pack.
Isn't it fascinating? Like they are so gung ho on giving competition to Oculus. Like there's a side of them that does not want Facebook to own the VR space.
Philosophical. This is Gabe Newell. This makes total sense.
And
I think we're among those people, right?
Absolutely. And they have made so many strides in for VR. And they were responsible for making the prototype that Oculus used in order to help prototype their own stuff. But they have not released a game.
Because it's very much a developers model.
Exactly.
Trust the devs.
Despite the fact that they are one of the best game developers in the entire world.
Own one of the strongest, at least, one of the most notable IPs.
Or two or
two
three.
Two or three, yeah. Right, with Portal and Team Fortress.
So hopefully that's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. On the mobile side of VR, we had Firefox VR browser. That launched for the Oculus Go, a competitor to the built-in VR browser. Not fully featured yet, doesn't incorporate some things that people might want, like such as streaming 360 video, but it's an alternative. You installed this on your Go, right, Jeremy?
Yeah, I did. I didn't know it didn't support 360 video, because I tapped something, it was 360 video.
Oh, maybe that's stereo video.
Yeah, that's true. It's great. I don't imagine I'll be browsing the web very much, but it is a way to watch YouTube, and the browser's done well. It's all made for VR, nice keyboard. You can do voice search, though, which is probably the most important feature.
And then also two upcoming launches with release dates for at least one of them. Tetris Effect, which we saw at E3, is coming out, November, I want to say?
Across all platforms?
No, it's PlayStation exclusive.
Oh, are they really doing
PS4,
that?
PS4.
I'll bet that's
November 9th.
That's a timed exclusive.
November 9th, this is a game that would be perfect on the go. Tetris Effect.
Yeah.
No track controllers, just great music experience. Yeah. And then Rec Room announced their next quest.
they showed a a poster, concept art for the next quest.
I love the title.
Looks very Halloween themed.
Crescendo of the Blood Moon.
There is an avatar, a rec room with standing in front of a gate, in front of an evil castle, and he is holding, he or she is holding, a whip.
Very Castlevania.
Exactly. Yeah. The logo evokes Castlevania, so I like where they're going, and we'll jump in. I can't wait to spend more time.
Don't you think it's a Halloween time frame?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If concept art is coming out in the first few weeks and a teaser, yeah, definitely before the end of the year. But I think Halloween is tight. That's only like 5 weeks away.
Yeah. Oh, it's been a while, though. It's been quite a while since we ventured into the Isle of Lost Skulls.
Just bring back the pistol. Bring back something that's cool to use.
You know, they finally added all those weapons to the maker stuff, so you can add your own, make your own room with those weapons in it.
And then, oh, going back to something we missed about The Void. The Void also announced that they're partnering with Disney to do 5 new experiences. So right now they have the Ghostbusters experience, the Star Wars experience, and they're doing 5 new ones. The next one will be for a promotion for Wreck-It Ralph 2, Ralph Breaks the Internet.
So where will you be able to play these?
I think that their system has to be modular, and they can just move the walls around.
Well, yeah.
And they'll say for time, you know, this week we're doing just Ralph stuff.
But unless they use the same physical architecture, they can't let you choose which one you want
to
play.
No, you have to go. It's a location based.
They could, though. They could do that.
That would be not as fun.
Would it? I mean,
no, they're specifically designed, like the heaters and the moving platforms and rumbling pads.
But you got to think in terms of a company. Like, they want to be able to do both at the same time so that they can have that
generated. I think they want to be able to turn around them at the same time. And I think they believe their experiences are compelling enough that for people who are repeat visitors, it's like, make an appointment. It's like a theater experience. For the next 2 weeks, we're doing this Marvel thing. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to go back to the standard Star Wars thing. For these next 2 weeks, make your appointment now. Because it's all kind of buy your tickets ahead of time and then get there at a certain time.
Speaking of theater experience, I think that's where this should go. I think this should go at a place like a Metreon or something like that.
It needs so much space.
It does need space, but movie theaters are where like they could upsell this tremendously, especially if they're going to tie to movie releases.
Yeah, it has a real problem with throughput, with getting people in there fast enough.
No, but if you're doing online booking for it, it's just going to be sold out. But no, that's fine. That's not a problem.
For me, it is, because it is always sold out. Like, if you're going to be at a movie theater, you're going to want people to be able to do impulse buys and dive in there and, you know, charge appropriately for it.
They basically need to extend the experience and make the interesting, you know, Disney optimize the line experience. Make the line interesting. Have all your other peripheral non-VR tutorials and video things.
Yeah.
Watch the trailer a couple times before you jump into the VR thing, right? Make the queue interesting.
I wonder if The Void will ever get to the home in some way or another. Sell their experiences to home for home use.
Oh, I don't imagine that. Franchising might make some sense, right? Or parties. Maybe that's like, you know, corporate events, right? We'll deploy a Void thing for your 200 employees for this event.
Oh, good. Tested should do that. Well, we don't have 200 employees.
We don't have 200 employees. Or the space to do it. Yeah. Good idea, though.
Thanks.
And I think that does it for this week's podcast. Next week we might have a late episode or early episode, depending when we want to record it, around Oculus Connect 5. But as always, thank you for listening. Jeremy, do we have an outro this week?
I was looking for this one that somebody emailed me, because I never play it and I want to get it out of my email box.
While he's doing that, what's coming up on Tested?
Coming on Untested this week, we have videos from some recent visits to the cave. I can say that we have a video, might be out today, with puppeteer Barnaby Dixon, who visited Adam's Cave, as well as a project that he did that Jeremy contributed to. We talked about last week, the Star Child project is finally finished from 2001. And we'll have some OC5 content, hopefully, around or after OC5, and then we're rolling into New York Comic Con. If you're going to New York Comic Con, let us know. We'd love to see you there. Kishore, you're going to be there?
I will be there.
I will be there. Adam will be there. And
Joey will be there.
And Joey will be there. Yeah.
I was just going to say, and we're not going to be at New York Maker Faire, World Maker Faire, but a lot of the Tested family will be there.
Yeah. Send us pictures if you're at New York Maker Faire. I'd love to see projects that are there.
It's by a new fella named Oz Muzzo.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested. Do you think it's okay to drive stone?
Get a DUI.
Stone.
Do not get behind the wheel.
Wow.
That's an ad for NHTSA.
That's a good one.
All right. Thanks for listening. Bye.